I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. President Obama recently submitted his budget for next year, a $3.8 trillion plan that covers everything from highway spending to tobacco taxes. But since its release, much of the conversation about this budget has focused on one item, his proposed change to the way Social Security benefit increases are calculated, a method called chained CPI. It would mean slightly lower annual increases, about one-quarter, 1% less. Sounds small, but those numbers do add up over time, and that's why liberal groups are outraged at the president's proposal, calling it a benefit cut masquerading as a technical adjustment. But there are plenty of voices in support of the president, too, including the leaders of the bipartisan Simpson-Bowles Commission, whose plan for debt reduction was widely praised on both sides of the aisle. Today in The Exchange, social insecurity, what this is all about, why it struck such a nerve, and what role this chained CPI might play in Social Security reform. Let's get you into our conversation. From what you've heard, does Social Security need repair? If so, what changes should be made? Are you aware of this idea of chain CPI that's being talked about? What are your questions or thoughts about it? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. With me in studio, Steve Gorin, professor of social work at Plymouth State University, chairman of the New Hampshire State Committee on Aging, and executive director of the New Hampshire chapter of the National Association of Social Workers. And Steve, it's nice to see you. Thank you
nice
for being
to see
here.
You, Laura.
Also joining us by phone, Mark Goldwine, Senior Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, a bipartisan nonprofit organization. And Mark, thank you for your time as well.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us, Phil Moeller, contributing editor for U.S. News and World Report, where he writes the Best Life blog. He's been writing about this Social Security debate. Phil is also a research fellow at the Sloan Center on Aging and Work at Boston College. And Phil Moeller, great to have you too. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Well, and Phil, I'll start with you. I gave a brief definition of chained CPI, but let's get a little bit more. What's the biggest difference between chained CPI and the way CPI, or, you know, the rate of inflation, as we all know it, is calculated? What are we talking about here?
Well, the biggest difference is that the chained CPI is going to rise less than the figure we now use. So that's the ultimate impact here, that it will result in smaller increases in the cost of living adjustment for Social Security recipients than the current index. The reason it's smaller is that the chain CPI measures price changes in a different way than the CPI that's now used. We can get into the weeds further on if people want to, but fundamentally, it's a different index. It tries to measure the prices that people pay for the things they actually buy rather than using a static market basket of things. So, for example, if meat prices change and steak becomes more expensive, people are probably going to buy less steak, but they're going to buy more of other cuts of meat. And the chain CPI tries to measure what they actually spend money on in terms of what they do with their money. And so whether that results in a lower quality of life, that's a big issue about the chain CPI in terms of whether you think an index should measure what people actually spend for the same quality of life in terms of their consumer purchases. But it does more accurately reflect what people actually do with their money.
So it has to do partly, Phil, with product substitution then.
Yeah,
you know, if steak is expensive, I buy cheaper steak.
Right. There's a lot more to it than that, but in terms of what, you know, mere mortals like me can understand, that's really where I'd start with it today.
So how do economists in general feel about chain CPI? Do they feel like it's a better reflection of inflation than what we use now, that we should all switch to this?
Well, you know, you can line up economists any which way you want to these days in terms of variety of opinion. But from what I can tell, the majority opinion is that chain CPI is a technically better way to measure prices than is the current CPI. But that's a separate debate, if you will, from whether the current CPI is even the best way to measure prices for older consumers. And that's another component of this debate.
And, you know, different age brackets definitely consume different things. It's often been said that older consumers consume more health care, for example, and perhaps their houses are paid for, so they consume on a budgetary basis less housing.
Absolutely.
It does get into the weeds, doesn't it? And I want to bring our other guests into this as well. And Mark Goldwine, to you, you know, letters to the editor, phone calls, emails. I mean, this has caused a huge reaction, this seemingly technical concept, chain CPI. Why has this turned into such a big deal?
Yeah, I think it's really unfortunate. Back in the 90s, we corrected inflation in a similar way. We did administratively. There was not a peep from anyone. But because this is visible and because it affects the thing maybe the left cares about most, Social Security, and the thing the right cares about most, the tax code, there's been, I think, a disproportionate backlash about what is actually a relatively modest policy.
So what's the backlash about then? What do you think, Mark?
Well, for the left, this changes Social Security benefits. Social Security benefits will grow slower because they'll grow with a more accurate measure of inflation. It also increases revenue. Revenue will go faster because the brackets are growing with a slower measure of inflation. And neither side wants to touch those sacred cows of Social Security and taxes.
Can you just briefly explain, Mark, and then I want to get Steve Gorin in, too. We're talking about Social Security this hour, chain CPI, other proposals that have been talked about. But elaborate on the tax issue, because that has come up, too, that this will cause people's taxes to go up.
Sure. So to step back for a second, we measure a lot of things in the government using inflation, not just Social Security.
So this matters. How we measure it matters.
That's right. And one of those things that we index to inflation is the movement of the tax brackets. So every year, that 15% bracket, where it starts, that goes up a little bit to account for inflation. If inflation's slower, that bracket goes up a little slower, which means there's going to be, say, more people in the 25% bracket and less in the 15.
I see. So this is why this has caused outrage on the right and the left. And Steve Gorin, to you, I know you're upset about this chain CPI. Why do you think this is such a big deal?
Well, let me just start by thanking you for inviting me. And secondly, by saying I'm speaking for myself here, certainly not for the State Committee on Aging or Plymouth State University. I do want to make the point that this is an issue that is concern not only for progressives, for those on the left, who I think I'm assuming Mark was referring to traditional progressive organizations. It's really a broad concern for the public as a whole. A wide range of organizations are concerned about the chained CPI, including groups like the American Legion, because this would dramatically affect veterans' benefits, groups that don't usually weigh in on these kinds of issues. I guess I do agree that I assume, I'm not an economist, but I assume it's probably true that a number of economists believe that the chain CPI is the best measure for the population as a whole. There's great debate, and I don't think there's any certainty over whether it's the best measure of inflation for older adults and people with disabilities, including many veterans. I think there's wide disagreement about that, and I don't think we know. And I think before we rush into this, it would be far wiser to develop a separate measure for older adults and perhaps people with disabilities. There's something called the CP, and I don't want to get into the weeds, the CPIE, which is an experimental measure, and there are problems with it. But that was created by Congress in the late 1990s, actually signed into law by Ronald Reagan as a way to try to address the spending patterns of older adults. I don't think we've gotten there and done that. But I think before we make this potentially drastic change, we should really know what we're doing.
Well, and this gets into bigger questions that we'll dig into perhaps a little bit later, Steve, about whether Social Security is in dire straits or not, whether it needs major reform, minor tweaks, and so forth. But from what I've read, Steve, this will mean a reduction in the annual increase of the average person's Social Security check of 0.25%. So, again, why the fuss?
Well, I think when you really break that down, it's really much more dramatic, and I'm just looking for these figures that I have here. There was a study that was done by the National Women's Law Center that projected that for a typical single elderly woman by age 75, before the first bump up, and the bump up, again, as I said, a technical issue, but one we should address, the Obama administration, I think recognizing the problems with the chain CPI, would bump up people's benefits at age 75 and then later. But by age 75, before the first bump up begins, the cut from the chain CPI would reduce a typical single elderly woman's monthly benefit by an amount equal to the cost of 5 days' worth of food each month. That strikes me as a major thing. And if you look at AARP, has some startling figures for the impact it would have on a 30-year-old disabled veteran who has a lifetime.
It's worth mentioning that it isn't just the elderly who receive Social Security benefits. The number for you to join us here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And just real quickly to you again, Steve Gorin, remind us who else gets Social Security besides the elderly, even though that's the main focus.
Well, actually, a wide range of people. It's really why it's called Social Security. Social Security, I don't think it's widely known, is the largest federal program that we have for young people. I forget the exact figures, but many young people get survivor's benefits if they have parents who pass away prematurely. And then there's SSDI, which is Social Security Disability Insurance. So there are really a wide range of people who this would affect.
People who are on disability because they can't work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I know that's something.
And SSDI is different from SSI. I want to make that clear.
But is it all part of Social Security?
Well, SSI in a way is related, but SSDI is Social Security Disability Insurance. And that's a very different program.
All right. Lots to untangle. And we will talk a lot more after a short break about this chained CPI idea and the broader questions that underlie this effort by the president to adopt chained CPI for Social Security and other federal programs. We'll take your questions and comments to the exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Stay with us.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. Support this news service by becoming a member of NHPR's Leadership Circle at the $1,000 level. When you do, current Circle members Tilman Gerngross, Sylvia Richards, and Barbara and Dick Couch will add $500 onto your gift. Your money goes further today when you join the NHPR Leadership Circle. Visit the support page at nhpr.org. More on social and Social Security coming up on The Exchange and at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, who benefits from college and why. Support for NHPR comes from, you are members, from Dana-Farber New Hampshire Oncology, Hematology in Londonderry, offering specialized cancer services including genetic testing and survivorship care, danafarber.org/Londonderry. And the Community College System of New Hampshire congratulating the class of 2013 who made the community college part of their educational path, ccsnh.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Social Security and the president's proposal for changes to the program. We're looking specifically at his idea for something called chained CPI that would change the way that benefit increases are calculated. It sounds technical, but as we're hearing, there are lots of concerns about its impact. The phone number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. From what you've heard, do you think Social Security needs repair? If so, what changes do you think would be appropriate? Also, if you've heard about this idea of chain CPI, what are your questions about it? What are your thoughts about it? Again, you can call in 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Philip Moeller, I'd love your thoughts, too, on just how big a change this is. You know, we hear that it will only mean a reduction of 0.25%. Doesn't sound like a lot. But then Steve Gorin says, well, it depends on how you look at it.
It compounds over time. That's 0.25% less every year for the rest of your life if you're a Social Security recipient. So AARP and others have done projections that show that for somebody with a typical benefit today who starts taking Social Security, after 25 years, they would be getting more than $2,000 less a year in Social Security payments, or about $1,000 in inflation-adjusted dollars. So I don't care how you cut it, that's a big change. And so it would have a substantial impact over time. I do want to say, though, that's not the only basis on which you should vote yay or nay on this chain CPI approach. I think the broader discussion that hopefully we can get into today is how we need to adjust the program overall, and whether just addressing the chain CPI is a wise idea outside the broader context of what the program overall needs. And I think that's where a lot of the criticism has come from.
Right. And so let's get into that a little bit. And I also have some emails and calls that I want to go to. But let's get into that a little bit, gentlemen. So Mark Goldwine, here's another critique. Never mind the details about chain CPI and how big a hit or how small a hit. There are those who say, Mark, look, Social Security is not in big trouble. It doesn't need big changes. It's working well. Maybe some tweaks around the margin. What do you think, Mark?
You know what? It doesn't need big changes, but it is in big trouble. 20 years from now, a lot of folks say 20 years from now, chain CPI will be a 5% cut. Actually, it's a 25% increase because scheduled under current law, the trust fund runs out of money in 2033. That year, everybody gets across the board cut of a quarter of their benefit. Doesn't matter if you're 99 years old. And dirt poor, or if you're 62 years old and rich, everybody gets a 25% cut. That's what's scheduled in law if we don't do something to make this system whole.
So in 2033, the trust fund runs out of money, and at that point, people will still get benefits, but they'll be reduced by 25%? Is that what you're saying, Mark?
An immediate reduction of 25% for everyone.
So take a small hit now. That's what you're saying.
I'm saying we can make gradual changes now that give people time to plan, time to save, time to change their work habits, that are focused more towards people that can afford it more, the wealthy. And by doing so, we can avoid a dramatic 25% cut to everybody later.
Okay, and this is the fundamental argument. And Steve Gorin, I know you have lots of thoughts there. Just very briefly, for the moment, what about this idea? Social Security is going to run out. Let's make some small adjustments now before it's too late.
Well, the trust fund's going to run out. As Mark pointed out and you reiterated, it's not that Social Security is going to be dead or bankrupt completely. As long as people are working and there are payroll taxes, Social Security will take in money. It's that 25% shortfall we have to make up. I think there are much better ways of making up that shortfall. One thing we could do is lift the cap in which people are taxed. The cap last year was $110,100. So people who made above that were not taxed.
Yeah, remind us what the cap is, how that works, because that's often surprising for people, Steve.
Yeah, people are Social Security taxes.
Payroll taxes.
Payroll taxes, individuals, only on the first, last year, $110,100 of their earnings. So anybody who makes above that is not paying the Social Security payroll.
So in other words, if I make $110,000 and you make $210,000, you and I both pay the same Social Security tax.
Correct.
So some people say, let's tax the full amount of income, the payroll taxes.
Or even up to $250,000, $300,000.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting, Phil, this is an idea that has been tossed around, boy, I don't know how many times. How come this never changes? Why is this so so difficult?
Well,
it's a million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the right question.
Right.
Why do we have continual crisis in Washington over the federal spending ceiling? Why can't Congress get together on deficit reduction issues? Why is our tax system not functional the way it should be? Why do we continue to have these commissions such as Simpson-Bowles and other commissions that come out with very well-reasoned and researched sets of proposal that Congress does not act upon? So you tell me why Congress doesn't act, and I'll tell you why we haven't fixed Social Security, which by all accounts is a relatively modest set of changes especially compared with the serious entitlement issues we face on the healthcare side.
Well, and I guess my question was less broad, Phil. It was this idea of the fact that after $110,000, as Steve Gorin explained, you don't pay any more payroll taxes. And people have been saying for a long time, some people, hey, that's not fair. You know, let's pay payroll taxes on your full income.
Sure. There are two points here. One is there are many in Congress, Tea Party and others, who have never seen a good tax. So any increase in taxes will run into stiff headwinds today in Washington. The other issue in terms of Social Security is that historically, Social Security has been a benefit program for everyone. It's very progressive in that lower-income people get a much greater percentage of their earnings credited for their Social Security payments. But at the higher end, even relatively wealthy people get Social Security benefits, and it's been long thought that there's a pretty wide social buy-in to Social Security. If you raise the earnings tax, it means effectively you're saying that wealthier people are going to basically be viewed as the cash cows to support the system, and their benefits are going to be a much, much smaller percentage of their earnings than they are today. That's not a broad-based program in America, and it turns it much into more of a tax program to redistribute income, which is not sort of consistent with the way we've used Social Security over the years. It changes the nature of the program. There are some people who think it will change the nature of social support for the program.
All right, let's take some calls and emails from our listeners. Lots of people want to jump in our conversation. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. We're talking about the future of Social Security this hour on The Exchange, and specifically a proposal that President Obama put out there to change the way Social Security benefit increases are calculated using something called chained CPI. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And in Colebrook, Denise is waiting. Hi, Denise. Go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think it was only in the last 3 or 4 years that we were talking about how the CPI all by itself does not include increases in cost of fuel and food. And so we didn't get a raise in Social Security for a few years there because everything stayed the same while the price of gas and fuel oil and price of food went skyrocketing. And everybody was going, oh my gosh, why aren't we getting more money here? I'd like to walk into the weeds, but I'd like to keep my feet on the ground too and realize that it's very difficult when you're living on Social Security, when this is all just technical gobbledygook. When you're actually on the ground. So in the real life, you have to pay for your heating oil. In real life, you have to pay for your food.
So, Denise, are you saying that inflation, the CPI, doesn't include increases in food and fuel? I thought that it did.
It seemed to me that last time we were talking about this, as I say, like 3 or 4 years ago, when we didn't get any increases in Social Security, the CPI did not include increases in food and fuel. Those are considered too volatile to be factored into the Consumer Price Index.
Even though they've gone up a lot. All right, let's clarify that then. Mark Goldwein, go ahead. What do you think?
Denise, that's a great... So what you're referring to is something called the core inflation, which takes out fuel and food, but the regular measure of inflation, the CPI, does include those measures. Actually, the main reason for that lack of COLA for a couple of years was that after fuel prices spiked significantly, they came back down pretty dramatically. And so that zero COLA year was the year when fuel prices actually dropped pretty significantly.
COLA's cost of living adjustment.
Exactly. So in other words, the CPI, the inflation measure does include fuel and food.
So your regular old-fashioned inflation measure does include food and fuel, but people didn't get a cost of living adjustment more recently, Mark, because, explain it again.
So the main reason was fuel prices had shot up pretty dramatically in 2007, and then they dropped down just as dramatically. So because fuel prices dropped down, there was actually some deflation that took place for a couple of years.
Okay. Denise, thank you for the question. It's a good one and important to clarify. Here's an email from Jillian who says, the media has tried to portray this as a generational fight But I'm in my 20s, and I want to say that I support Social Security and don't want the chain CPI. I want to retire someday, and I pay into Social Security. This is true of all young people. Jillian also goes on to say that she doesn't want her retirement in private investments. The financial crisis showed the stock market is volatile. The last thing I want to do is hand my retirement savings over to Wall Street bankers. Let's deal with the first part of her question first. And Mark, to you again, a generational fight. You're of a younger generation. Do you think that younger people have different feelings about Social Security reform than older people?
Well, look, this shouldn't be a generational fight because all grandparents love their grandkids and all grandkids love their grandparents. But if you do want Social Security to be there for you in the form it is today, we're going to need to make some modest changes. And it's best to make them now, you can have time to plan, adjust what you're doing through other savings and other work in order to prepare for the system as it will be.
Yeah. Phil, what's your take on Jillian's point? She doesn't want a generational fight. What do you think?
I agree with Mark that the best way we've done our younger people a real disservice by not addressing Social Security issues, because what we've done is tremendously weakened their faith that this system will be here for them. And if you look at polling results, the percentage of younger people who think they can rely on Social Security has been shrinking over the years. The best thing we can do for younger people is to right-size the financing of Social Security so that they know it's going to be there for 75 years. To me, that is the way for it not to be a generational issue.
What do you think about that right size, Steve Gorin, Social Security? We hear that, you know, it's coming under strain. You know, people are living longer. Healthcare costs are growing, that it's unsustainable in its current form.
Well, I guess I don't agree with that. People are living longer from birth. But if you look at life expectancy from age 65, that really skews by income. Upper income people, the life expectancy at age 65 of upper income people has expanded much more dramatically than that for lower income people. I just want to very quickly go back to one point that Phil made earlier. I do agree that we can't look to the wealthy entirely to fund Social Security.
This is the raising the cap on payroll taxes.
The great strength of Social Security has been that everybody's in the same boat. I do agree with that completely. There have been proposals introduced into Congress that would raise the cap, but also give improved benefits for people who pay an additional amount. So that's something I would support. I don't think raising the cap can solve the entire problem.
All right, Jillian, thanks for the email. And again, our email address for you to join us with your questions, comments, concerns, exchange@nhpr.org or call 1-800-892-6477. And from West Deering, Bill is on the air. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange.
Oh, good morning. Good morning, Laura. I'm very much against the chain CPI. I would like, you know, I'm in my 70s. I worked, you know, hard on heavy construction all my life. And I'd like to ask your guest who supports chain CPI, if he knows what it feels like to try to live on $1,200 a month with the rising cost of groceries, utilities, medicine, and furthermore, the chain CPI would cut benefits for over 3 million disabled veterans. The simplest way out, which they don't seem to want to admit to, would be to take and raise the cap, even to $250,000. Okay, and why not, you know. Another thing, Wall Street had my retirement account and trashed it. And I mean, it cut it by 3/4. I realize I'm not the only one that got that hit.
So a vote for raising the cap, like we talked about earlier. And I'm glad you called, Bill. He's raising, as Jillian did in her email, concern about putting retirement in private investments. This is something that President Bush put out there. But Mark, is anybody talking about this right now?
You know, there's not really any move towards privatization. On the caller's other comments, I do think that what you point out is a structural issue with the current system, which is it's not doing right by everyone right now, and it's not providing benefits that are significant enough for many long career workers that deserve them. That said, measuring inflation wrong, I don't think is the right way to account for that. We should have other changes to the system that make it more robust. I do think raising the cap is one of those, but as both other guests mentioned, that by itself won't be enough.
Well, and here's something else that Bill raised. You know, he mentioned that he paid into the system over his many years in the workforce. Here's a question for everybody. Mark, I'll start with you again. The idea that whether Social Security should even be part of debt and deficit reduction deals, given that this program is a different nature of most government programs. It's a program people pay into over their lifetimes with the expectation that they'll get some of that money back. So what about that, Mark? You can't make this as part of your regular old debt reduction deals. It's different.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, there's two ways to look at Social Security, both very fair. One is part of the rest of the government and one is on as its own sake. Both lead you really to the same conclusion, which is that we need to make some changes to Social Security. I do agree we should be looking at the system as a whole. We should be focused on 75-year solvency, not on what this is doing for the next 10 years. But just because we're dealing with a separate track doesn't mean we don't have to deal with it.
What do you say, though, to people who say, look, I paid in. Don't take away what I paid in. What do you think, Mark?
Sure. If you look again at where the trust fund is going, yes, people contribute to payroll tax, but there's not enough payroll tax to pay out benefits. So there's a disconnect between what has been paid in and what has been promised or what has been scheduled. So through some combination of increasing what people pay in and slowing the growth of what people take out, we need to bring those back into balance.
And so, Steve, this is the point that, what I pay in isn't necessarily what I'm going to pull out. I may pull out a lot more than what I paid in. That's the imbalance there. I wonder what you think about that.
Well,
This shouldn't be part of debt reduction.
Oh, I definitely think
it should be.
It shouldn't be. It doesn't. The reality is that Social Security does not add to the deficit. The reason why in 2033, if we do nothing, and I don't think we'll do nothing, I think we'll fix it as we did in 1983. But if we did nothing, the trust fund would run out of money and Social Security would have a 25% shortfall. The reason for that is that it can't borrow. And if it can't borrow, it can't add to the deficit. So I agree it should not be at all part of deficit discussion.
What about the imbalance, though? Again, if I live to 90, I'm going to pull out probably a lot more than what I put in.
Well, I think as long as we can fix that 25% shortfall, that's not an issue. I mean, Mark mentioned a 75-year period. That's the period that the Social Security actuaries look at. If we could fix it for 75 years, that wouldn't be a problem.
Through other methods.
And I don't think we should discourage people from living longer.
All right. We'll take more of your calls and emails after a short break. Thanks for those. We'll be right back.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Faulkner's Nursery with gift ideas for Mother's Day, annuals, perennials, and flowering trees and shrubs, including lilacs, roses, and hydrangea. Route 3 in Hooksett and at FaulknersNursery.com. And from Raff Young and Pignatelli with law offices in Concord, Nashua, and Boston, National Impact, uniquely New Hampshire, on the web at rafflaw.com. This is NHPR.
I'm Laura Kanoy. Join me and a panel of reporters, editors, and analysts for the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup.
I think the House Democratic Caucus is going to determine whether casino gambling goes through.
And they've created a super committee of the House Finance and House Ways and Means committees to do it as a joint.
14 states now have some sort of a home grow provision in their laws, including, of course, Vermont.
We'll talk through the big Granite State stories of the week. The Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, Friday mornings at 9 on The Exchange from NHPR. And this is The Exchange on NHPR. Tomorrow on The Exchange, the struggle in Syria and what, if anything, the U.S. should do in response. Email us your thoughts on this at nhpr.org and be sure to join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, we're looking once again at Social Security proposals to change the program from President Obama, a rather technical proposal called Chained CPI. We've been looking at that, but also more broadly about how much change Social Security might need, whether it's in good fiscal shape or not. We're taking your questions and comments, too, at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Kathy is calling in from Manchester. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for taking my call. My questions go more to those not paying into the system. I'm getting ready for retirement probably within 5 years and was surprised to see, and I'm hoping I misunderstood it, that people that have never contributed to the Social Security system, and I'm not talking about those that might have an unfortunate incident where they're collecting from their spouse or children collecting from a parent that there may have been an injury or death in the family, but just the general population that's never contributed that are allowed to have Social Security, and also that Social Security was never really designed for the disability end of it, and I'm thinking that those figures are on the rise and why we don't consider a separate source of funding for the disabled versus just coming out of Social Security.
No. Yeah, two good points. Thank you, Kathy, for raising those. And I think to you first, Mark Goldwine, who is getting Social Security who has not paid into it? This is what Kathy's first question was.
Yeah, so these are both good questions. With the exception of spouses or other dependents, you cannot collect Social Security unless you've paid into the system for 10 years.
So even if you don't pay regular income taxes, you're still paying payroll taxes no matter how little money you might make.
That's right. And in terms of the disability program, it actually does have its own portion of the payroll tax that's dedicated just for disability. And now, of course, we do need to reform that program as well, but it's not taking from the old age Social Security fund.
I see. It's separate. You have written, though, about the disability fund, Mark, I know, and talked about some need for changes there.
I have. Unlike the full system that runs out in 2033, the disability system runs out of money in just 3 years.
Wow. Philip, can you also jump in on Kathy's question? Because I'm guessing it's one that other listeners might have.
Sure. I think the distinction is important between income taxes and payroll taxes.
Right.
So it is true that people who pay no income taxes can still collect Social Security if they paid payroll taxes into the system. And again, it's a complex system, but you have to have been earning money for 40 different quarters over the last number of years. They don't have to be consecutive quarters, but you need that earnings history in order to qualify for Social Security. I do think in terms of the disability, we have had a rising pattern of applications for disability coverage, which is very predictable based on the seriousness of the recession that we've been in. People just have problems and they are going to seek redress where they can, and so applications for disability are up. And even though the fund has its own disability component, the historical way of dealing with that disability shortfall is to change the ratio of how that payroll tax is allocated. So in effect, unless we do something to help the overall system in order to help the disability fund, it's probably going to have to, in effect, take money from the rest of those payroll tax revenues in order to meet their needs. And so we're going to have an issue in terms of dealing with the disability fund that will affect, I think, all of Social Security.
Okay, so again, to clarify Kathy's question, Phil, people who've never contributed to Social Security but who receive it anyway are only those whose parents perhaps died when they were quite young, so they were children, or non-working spouses whose husbands die suddenly.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Thanks for the question, Kathy. Here's another great question from Patrice via email. She says, can someone explain why the changes made in 1983 didn't solve the shortfall we face today? A question I had too, Patrice. Thank you. Steve Gorin?
Well, that's a complicated issue, and I don't know if the other two guests want to address that.
We hear
well.
So much about that big reform back then and Ronald Reagan and so forth, and why didn't it last?
I don't know. Phil, were you about to?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, not to get too detailed because my memory is fuzzy, but we've sweetened the pot in the last 30 years. You know, the benefit structure that people get today is more attractive than it was when those reforms were enacted in 1983. So we've changed the rules of the game a little bit. And the other thing that's happened is that wages have increased at the top level by a disproportionate amount. So we are capturing less of the nation's wage base in that payroll tax than we were in 1983, which means that the system is not as sort of self-correcting in terms of wage changes as it may have been anticipated 30 years ago.
Wow, we keep getting back to that payroll tax threshold. Yeah, go ahead, Mark. Do you want to jump in?
I could jump in. The bigger problem was the 1983 reforms were literally only scheduled to get us through 75 years. So even at the time, they only would get us through 2058. So what we're now talking about is between 2058 and 2033. Things have gotten worse due to differences in economic growth and demographics and other things like that. But that reform was never designed to put us on a permanently sustainable path.
I see. All right. Thanks for the question again, Patrice. And let's go to Portland, Maine, and talk to Dan. Hi, Dan. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Sure. Good morning. Question for you. I'm 26 years old, and considering how much my income to put into private investment to supplement any Social Security payout that I might get in the future. One of your listeners earlier suggested that they wanted to keep their money away from Wall Street because they thought it was safer in a government investment. And I'm just I'm wondering if your columnist, your panelists, have any opinion as to whether or not your money is safer in one place or the other. And coming down from the ivory tower, coming out of an ideal world, you know, taking things like congressional gridlock into account, is putting your money and your show of support as a citizen behind Social Security a safer way to handle your retirement long term?
Wow. Okay. And that's almost more of an investment question, Mark, and probably most investment advisors would say, don't put your eggs all in one basket, to use an old cliche. But what do you think, Mark, about Dan's question? Thank you, Dan.
I think that's exactly right. Look, when you're making investment decisions, government bonds are the safest, but they're also the slowest growing. So what you want to do is a lot of risk isn't risk over a lifetime, but it's volatility. So when you're young, as it sounds like you are, you want to put more of your money in stock, not all in one stock. You want to put it in like an index that mixes up a bunch of stocks. And then as you get older, you want to go more and more into safe but slower growing bonds.
All right. Thanks for the question, Dan. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Steve Gorin, you want to jump in there?
Well, I thought I detected some concern in the caller's voice about whether Social Security would really be there.
Yes, and that is a concern among young people.
And
absolutely.
I understand. I mean, none of my students, despite what I say, really believe that Social Security will be there.
Really? They think it's just going to go away.
Yeah, they do. They do, because I think they've heard that so often. The great strength of Social Security and why I think it will be there for them is that it's so broadly supported. There is broad opposition to introducing the chain CPI. Groups across the political spectrum, from the Tea Party to progressive groups on the left, oppose the chain CPI. And any other changes that would have the potential to undermine Social Security. I think as long as we are a democracy, Social Security will be there.
Well, and you're getting to something I wanted to ask you about then, Steve. I mean, you're right. It's broadly supported. The so-called third rail of American politics, you know, touch it and you die. Does this go overboard, though, at some point, Steve, where no one wants to do anything and the program suffers as a result? We're afraid to make any change at all.
Well, I'm not so sure that's true. I think there would be support for raising the cap. I think if explained, it's possible that there could be. I agree there needs to be some modification, and this is just me speaking. It may be necessary at some point that there would need to be a minor increase in, I think it would be minor, in the payroll tax. But I think these are things that people can understand if explained.
Yeah, and this gets into the politics of it. Mark Goldwein, President Obama has taken a huge amount of heat from the left on this chained CPI idea. What's your take on the whole political difficulty of touching Social Security?
Oh, well, if you look historically, it's almost impossible to reform this program absent a crisis. The problem is, this time around, by the time we get to a crisis, it'll be too late. Now, I think President Obama deserves a lot of credit for putting chained CPI into his budget. I actually think he might have been better off, or we would be better off, if we had a full Social Security plan. So not only would we save money, but we can actually show we've made the system solvent. We've secured it for future generations. And in the process, we could actually enhance benefits for some groups that I think really need them.
So don't just approach chain CPI. You're saying he should have put other stuff on the table, too, that we've been talking about this hour, Mark?
Yeah, he would have taken a look. The political hit was already there, but at least he would have had a political benefit to go with it. He could have shown a solvent system.
A comprehensive plan, then, you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah, that's difficult, though, Phil, isn't it? Some liberal groups are already saying, look, Democrats, if you support this, we're going to primary you. We're going to find liberals who oppose it and make sure that you're out.
Well, and let me take Mark's point and sort of raise the ante a bit. The real problem in this country is not just Social Security. It's the entire retirement system. We set aside way too much money for retirement out of our own funds. We then make bad investment choices. We sell at the wrong time. We stay out of the market when it recovers, which is what's happened to a lot of people in the last 3 years. As a result, we have an overall retirement system that doesn't work as well as it should. It's why Social Security has become important way out of the proportion that it was designed to be when it was first constructed. I mean, a third of all retired people depend on Social Security for 90% or more of their retirement income.
Wow, and private pensions are gone practically.
They're
right?
gone.
We don't get
and so
that
we're talking about the 401k system and other retirement programs. They need a lot of attention as well. I mean, the political courage that we need in this country is to take a look at the entire system. Social Security is an important component, but it's hardly alone. And people need to come to terms with the fact that we're going to have a train wreck of massive proportions as baby boomers have to retire on totally insufficient private nest eggs and a Social Security system that is in need of financial repair as well. But we really need to focus on these issues, and I don't see the political will to do that.
Let's take one more call if we could. John's waiting in Sharon. Hi, John, you're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question, I guess, is, you know, someone like me who makes about $50,000 a year, I pay 100% on all my income in Social Security. So everything I earn is taxed to Social Security. Why,
sure.
then, does a guy making $1 million only pay one-tenth of salary to Social Security? Or he only pays on one-tenth of his salary? I don't see the need for a cap at all. I think, why is it that, I have no complaint about people making money and wealthy people, that's fine. But why are they rewarded for the fact that they make more money than I do? I don't understand that.
Well, this gets back to that threshold, Steve Gorin. Again, over $110,000, you're not taxed for Social Security payroll taxes on that money above that level. So John's upset about that.
I don't blame him. The cap was lifted on Medicare, but it does exist on Social Security. And I do agree that it is a problem, with the caveat that I think if people put in more money, they should get more money back in benefits. I don't think we should target the wealthy per se. I think we want their support for this program, but I agree.
But do they need those benefits? I mean, could you argue that, look, they've already got good private retirement accounts, maybe even a private pension, even though those are getting rarer and rarer?
Well, I think at that point...
isn't the point to bring in more money to the system?
It is, but I think at that point you're starting to talk about means testing Social Security, which I think would be a terrible mistake. I have nothing against welfare programs at all or people who need them. But I don't think we want to turn Social Security into what essentially could become a welfare program.
Well, and Mark Goldwine, we started out talking about President Obama taking a lot of heat for this chained CPI idea. It would have applied to all federal programs, but especially people are talking about Social Security. Where do you think this is going to go, Mark?
Well, look, I think that if we can have a big comprehensive budget deal, I do think this will be part of it, because as painful as this is, measuring inflation accurately is easier than some of the other tough choices. That said, I do worry that instead of making these tough choices, what we do is we stay in this sequester world where we just accept, you know, not a 4% cut 20 years from now, but a 8 to 10% across the board cut to a lot of really important programs that people are really relying on.
So you're saying we should apply this chain CPI idea to the whole federal government, including Social Security, including all the other programs, and that'll help us get this debt and deficit under control.
And get rid of this mindless sequestration, which is just cutting spending ruthlessly across the board right now.
Phil, what do you think? Where's this going to go?
I'm afraid that we will kick the can down the road as long as we can.
Human nature, isn't it, to some extent?
This is, I mean, we've been looking for reforms for a long time. Simpson Bowles is not perfect, but it was a serious and well-researched effort to try to address these issues, and we're nowhere with that right now. So I agree with Mark. It may take some kind of unforeseen crisis to get people motivated to do the right thing. So it's one of these outcomes that you can't predict because it's not based on doing the right thing for the right reasons.
Phil, given the strong reaction, again, from the left about this chained CPI and from the right, as Steve Gorin mentioned, do you think this is going to go anywhere or just a lot of headlines and then it goes away?
Wow. I personally think we will not see the chained CPI adopted right now. But I'm basing that more on a lack of movement than I am on any particular political knowledge about a budget deal.
Yeah, just too difficult politically. What do you think, Steve Gorin? What's the end point here?
Well, I think, unfortunately, it's continued gridlock as well, and perhaps down the road a crisis and then we'll act. I think in many ways, I don't blame President Obama for this. I oppose the chained CPI. But I think I understand why he did it. I think it was an effort to demonstrate to the country that he was willing to meet his opponents halfway. I see no indication that they're willing to meet him halfway. And I think this whole debate about the chained CPI may be moot.
All right. Well, Steve, it's good to see you. Thank you for being here. Steve Gorin, president of social work at Plymouth State University. Mark Goldwine, thank you for your time as well.
Thank you.
Mark Goldwine, senior policy director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. And Phil Moeller, thank you very much for being with us.
Laura, thank you.
Phil Moeller, contributing editor for U.S. News and World Report. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our intern is Faith Meixel and Tim Camerato. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.